Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. On today's show, the journalist and activist Sarah Jaffe will talk about the revival of the Occupy movement in New York in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, and writer and artist Anne Elizabeth Moore talks about Cambodia, the subject of her gorgeous little book, Hip Hop Apsara, Ghosts, Past and Present. But first, some words in the news. I wasn't here last week because of Hurricane Sandy. I was personally very lucky, no damage, no loss of power, no loved ones displaced or hurt. My Brooklyn neighborhood, Clinton Hill, is 65 feet above sea level, a datum that I never thought would matter, but now does. As always happens after one of these major weather events, pundits obsess about whether it was a product of climate change. The conclusion is usually, well, we just can't be sure. That may be true in some crabbed literal sense, though the 5 degree warmer than normal ocean had something to do with the storm's intensity, but it's all part of a very scary pattern. As I've said here before, climate change is no longer a prospect for the future. It's here. Drought in the Corn Belt, savage hurricanes and tornadoes in New York City, not to mention all the vicious weather around the equator that Christian Parenti wrote about in Tropic of Chaos and talked about on this show. Sorry to deploy a cliché, but this is the new normal. So what now? In a few minutes, we'll hear from Sarah Jaffe about the excellent work the Occupy movement is doing at hurricane relief. But what about the longer term? There do seem to be some signs of dawning enlightenment among bourgeois politicians, though who knows how long that will last. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's endorsement of Obama, which cited climate change, was one. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's frequent mention of climate change in the days after the storm was another. And Obama's very brief mention of climate in his victory speech on Wednesday morning was a third. But do they mean it? And even if they do mean it, what does mean it mean? It's not breaking news for me to say that there are several urgent tasks facing us. Of course, getting beyond carbon-based energy is essential. Doing that challenges some of the most entrenched interests in American political economy: oil, auto, highways. It will require changes in the way we live: less sprawl, more density, more mass transit, much less waste. You can't just point to corporations as the villains, though God knows they have a lot to answer for. Daily life will have to change. But there are many things we'll have to do in the shorter term: mitigation and adaptation, in the jargon. Matt Iglesias, who's normally too neoliberal for my taste, had a very fine piece in Slate the other day outlining some of the things that could be done to protect New York from future floods. For about $15 billion, we could build gates in New York Harbor that would protect much of the city and suburban New Jersey and Long Island against catastrophic flooding. There are parts of the region that could not be protected, of course, those exposed most directly to the ocean. Beachfront property is lovely, but it may no longer be habitable in a climate-changing world. Of course, $15 billion sounds like a lot of money. It is in some sense, but we spent something like 200 or 300 times that much in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's about a week's worth of normal Pentagon spending. Michael Bloomberg, despite all his professed environmental concern, has said that he's not sure that cost is worth the benefit. But reflect on this. The mayor, who is the richest man in town, could pay the bill out of his own personal funds and still have $5 to $10 billion left over. Whose cost? Whose benefit? No doubt there are many other areas of the country that could use similar protection. If we were serious about adapting and mitigating, we could have a federal scheme funded at, say, $250 billion to start with to get working on these tasks. Again, sounds like a lot of money, but it's less than the combined net worth of the top 10 on the Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans. It's less than a third the Pentagon's budget. Instead of funding a military machine big enough to fight 2.5 wars simultaneously, how about funding a scheme that could keep our cities from drowning? And this sort of thing is always presented as just a cost. The damage from Katrina was in the order of $100 billion. Sandy, around $50 billion. There's much more of this to come. How about spending some to avoid these monetary costs, not to mention vast human suffering? Over the long term, a Green New Deal would have enormous environmental payoffs and could generate a wave of prosperity over decades. It's going to take a very active state to make that happen, and it's hard to imagine that coming out of the current configuration of power. Which takes me to the election. By all rights, Obama should have lost. The economy still stinks, and his approval rating going into the campaign was low. Plus, he's black. So his victory is fairly remarkable. I must admit that I am glad he won, not so much because he's so great, but because the Republican Party is a frightening thing. The demographic base, angry white men, is a shrinking share of the population for sure. White men were 46% of the electorate in 1980, the year the Reagan counter-revolution began. They were 34% of Tuesday's electorate. Not all white men are terrible. I like to think I'm not. But they are the most reliably right-wing demographic, and their angry subset isn't going down without a fight. But we shouldn't let fear of the right's horrors blind us to some realities. Obama is running secret, semi-secret, and open wars around the world. Mostly wars of a new kind featuring drones and special ops, but wars nonetheless. He's assassinating the people that Bush would have tortured. And at home, he will be under tremendous pressure from the establishment to agree to some kind of budgetary grand bargain, which always means cutting Social Security and Medicare. And he might actually agree with that agenda. He did, after all, appoint the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Commission, even though he didn't really have to. In other words, those of us looking for a more peaceful egalitarian world still have a big fight on our hands. The president of the U.S. is structurally the chief executive of the world bourgeoisie, and not a friend of the downtrodden. Back after a musical break.
Many years since I was here. On the street, I was passing my time away. To the left and to the right, buildings towering to the sky. It's out of sight in the dead of night.
That was some of, yes, Back in the New York Groove by, yes, Kiss. I can't say I'm back because I never left. Hurricane Sandy left behind a lot of wreckage in the New York area. The official response has left a lot to be desired. One noble exception, the transit workers who worked around the clock to get the city subway pumped out and running again. There were some horror stories about how it would take weeks, maybe months, to bring the subway back, but it's pretty close to normal now, just a bit over a week after the storm hit. But not all agencies have been so responsive. I've read and heard about the virtual absence of FEMA in shattered areas. Scores of thousands have been rendered homeless, and the official response has been less than impressive. Enter the Occupy movement. The new issue of the Baffler magazine features an article by its founder, Tom Frank, which reads like a smug obituary for Occupy Wall Street. Yet hardly had Frank's piece been unleashed on the world when Sandy hit, and the denizens of the Occupy movement sprang into action. Sarah Jaffe is a journalist who's been covering and participating in the movement since its beginning in September 2011. I had her on the show just over a year ago to discuss the movement in its first month of life. Now here she is again to discuss its revival as Occupy Sandy. I don't think this sort of thing is any substitute for effective state action, but when the state is slow to mobilize anything but its repressive forces, and thank God for mutual aid. It's wonderful to see Occupy kicking again. Sarah Jaffe. Welcome, Sarah. So Tom Frank recently pronounced Occupy dead, but it's anything but, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes.
So what are you finding?
Well, I'm finding, and a lot of people are finding, a lot of people who lost their homes are finding that Occupy is alive and well and is actually really good at providing care for people and providing food and clothing and shelter, and now they're starting to send out cleanup crews, I hear, to help take care of people who lost a whole bunch, and, you know, some people lost everything in this storm.
Describe the geography of disaster. This is, for a California audience originally, and, gets broadcast around the world. So just describe, people probably saw a lot of coverage of Lower Manhattan, but it's far worse than that, right?
Yeah. I mean, we saw that really sort of shocking picture that's on the cover of New York Magazine this week of half of Manhattan with the, no power. And that was shocking. And a lot of people, there are actually still people in Lower Manhattan who have no power. But the worst damage was in the outer boroughs, in places like Red Hook that in Brooklyn that's right on the water, or the Far Rockaways, which is where I was this weekend, which is like a narrow little strip of land that is a bay on one side and the ocean on the other, and the water just washed completely over it. So everybody has some flood damage. There were people who were showing me the stuff that the ocean washed in that was on top of their cars. They flooded over their cars. Entire first floor apartments were just completely full of water. Somebody's refrigerator was lifted up by the flood and stuck in the ceiling of their first floor. So it's really, really devastated. People who have just first floor apartments are homeless, sleeping in cars, sleeping in shelters. People who are in the public housing out there that goes up, 14 stories, they have no power. They're, stuck on top floor apartments because the elevator's not working. It's really bad, and it's not, it's not nearly as dramatic as the pictures of Lower Manhattan without water, but it's a lot worse.
I think a lot of people outside New York might not have any idea that the Rockaways exist, much less what it's like. So, what kind of community is it or was it?
There's several different communities out there. So Breezy Point, which was completely pretty much destroyed by a fire, was actually sort of a fairly affluent community. And then the place where I was in Arverne, which is basically a working class, mostly African-American neighborhood. A lot of people who own their homes, a lot of people who are renting. There's some public housing. But when I was out there on Sunday with an organizer from this group, New York Communities for Change, whose office I'm actually in right now, they were going door to door in the residential part, just talking to people, seeing what they needed, beyond just food and water, but what do you need? Do you need a flashlight? Do you need candles? Do you need medication? Is somebody in there sick? Do you have babies? Do we need to bring you diapers? And beyond that, trying to find out if we could send a truck out with a pump to pump out basements, if there was still water anywhere, and really trying to get a sense of, like you said, the geography of disaster, but the needs of this community, more specifically than sort of FEMA, which was just coming in and setting up, distribution sites where you could just come and get some bottled water and some food, or, dumping a package of whatever in the middle of the street and leaving people to sort it out themselves.
Yep, I was watching the local news channel, New York One, last night, and they had footage of people on the beach in the Rockaways burning wrecked furniture to stay warm. Is that the kind of thing you're seeing out there?
I mean, I was not out there at night. I was out there on Sunday. It's gotten a lot colder. Today I was standing in line to vote for an hour and a half and was freezing out there, and I can only just think about people who are out there right on the water, so you have the cold breeze right off the ocean, and yeah, and there's nothing. And, there's a lot of wrecked furniture to burn, if it will burn, because it's so wet. But, when you're walking down the street there, you would be forgiven for thinking everything's normal from a distance, and then suddenly you notice these giant piles of trash up front that are, kitchen tables and couches and everything, electronics, obviously. So I have no problem believing that people are having to do that, because there's so little, there's no power at all, and except for people who have generators, there's really just nothing out there, no protection, and there's no cell phone service either, because the cell phone towers aren't working either with no power, and so you can barely get a signal on your phone. So even though, there are some places that have set up charging stations, you can't really get news, so people are really disconnected from everything out there.
And of course, the subways aren't working, and people can't get gas, so they're kind of trapped.
Yeah, the relief effort has been really hampered by this gas shortage, right? Because there's no shortage of people who want to help. That's what this Occupy effort and these community groups have shown us, right? Is it like New Yorkers want to take care of each other? We actually aren't terrible people, like you've maybe heard. And there's tons of people who have cars, actually, and would not mind taking, deliveries out there. But when you can't get gas, you can't do that. So, that's possibly the worst thing. I'm sure it's probably cost lives.
Yeah, well, I can speak for myself. I got less than a quarter of a tank of gas, and I can't do anything, although I'd like to. Any signs of official relief efforts out there? I mean, the city, the state, or the federal government?
I mean, there are some. We saw the official distribution center. A lot of the people that I spoke to on Sunday were, shall we say, annoyed by what locations those official relief sites were set up in. They were not in their neighborhood. They were in the more affluent neighborhoods. They were in the whiter neighborhoods. And these people know it. They're not, you know, they're not surprised, but they're tired of it. I saw some police. That's what we saw in that neighborhood. We saw the police. One gentleman told me that the one thing in his house that wasn't destroyed, he was staying with a friend because his place is completely flooded. The one thing in his house that wasn't destroyed was his TV, and he didn't want to move it because the cops would try to arrest him for moving his own TV, because they would say he was looting because he's black. So, you know, these neighborhoods that are already over-policed are still being over-policed. We're hearing all these reports of people looting, and it's crazy out there, and, like, just like after Hurricane Katrina, what happens when you have those kind of reports is you get the police and the security in there before you get the aid in there. And, again, this kind of stuff costs lives.
I'm speaking with the journalist and activist, Sarah Jaffe. So how did the Occupy movement get together, when and where and how?
So, I mean, this is partly, you know, it just goes to prove Thomas Frank and many others who declared Occupy dead wrong to begin with, because these networks still existed. People were still in contact. People were still working on various projects. And so when some people, you know, basically sent out emails, text messages to their networks and said, hey, what can we do to help? And, you know, you see the same people in the distribution centers in, like, St. Jacoby Church that you used to see running the kitchen in Zuccotti Park or running the comfort station, making sure that people had clothes and warm blankets and clean socks. Doing what they were doing there, but doing it on a bigger scale. And the people who were doing tech stuff are now doing outreach, and they have Twitter accounts, and they have, yesterday I saw an interactive Google map with different pins on the different locations where you could take donations or where they could take volunteers. They've got now people in Jersey. And so all of the things that we were really impressed about happening in the park are now happening in these locations and online to do storm relief. And it just, again, it highlights the thing that I was really the most impressed with in the park to begin with, was like how quickly they could build an infrastructure and how quickly, you know, a quote-unquote leaderless movement could actually get things done and take care of basic needs very, very quickly and very well.
They're doing something that the state cannot do or is proving not capable of doing at this point.
I mean, it seems to be two levels, right? On the one hand, the state is going to sort of come in with big trucks and the National Guard, and they might be able to bring in a lot of supplies and mobilize very, very large quantities of aid, but they don't have connections in the communities. And that's why, even more so than Occupy, I think the community groups like New York Communities for Change, who I went out canvassing with on Sunday, I was out there on Sunday with their Far Rockaways organizer, right? They already know these communities. They already have a presence there. They already know places to go, and they already know which communities are going to be neglected by the state and which ones are going to be over-policed. And in the same way, the Occupy people in Red Hook very quickly connected with the Red Hook Initiative, which was a community center in Red Hook, and managed to set up their aid center there and reach out from there into the public housing and into the neighborhood. And again, they're really making an effort to reach out to people rather than just like setting up a station and saying, come here and get stuff, or just sort of dumping it and leaving this very, you know, this is almost creepy. I hate using the term third world, but like that's the term that the people who think like this would use. Right? As like, you just sort of have this mental picture of, you know, guys in camouflage throwing bottles of water and packages of food off the back of a truck. Right? And it's like the same picture that you get in Somalia or the same picture you get in Iraq. That's how they're treating people in New York. Because that's, you know, that's how this operates. Whereas people who are doing it from the ground up operate very, very differently and with a lot more compassion for the people that they're helping and a lot more, you know, acknowledgement of the fact that these people, that it's mutual aid, right? That it's not charity. You know, one of the gentlemen we canvassed on Sunday turned around and said, as soon as I'm finished cleaning up out my house, give me your phone number. I want to come volunteer. You know, it's not this, like, we're going to come in and save you in this afflicted community. It's like, we're going to help each other.
Yeah, you said this before. You know, people think of New Yorkers as a bunch of isolated, snarling, cruel people. But in fact, this is really an unmasked great level of solidarity.
Yeah, it's really, really. I mean, I think back to a couple of years ago when we had a really big snowstorm, and I was living in Lefferts Gardens at the time, which is sort of central Brooklyn, and my street wasn't plowed for 3-4 days, and the trains weren't running for 3-4 days. People couldn't get to work. People couldn't get pretty much anywhere. And the same sort of thing. People were helping each other. People were helping each other move stuff out, dig out their cars, try to dig out their cars anyway. To live this close to each other, we sort of have to pretend that other people don't exist or we'll go crazy. But as soon as people actually need each other, I've been continually impressed with how quickly New Yorkers jump to help each other out.
You said earlier that the networks that people developed during during the height of Occupy were reactivated. But what's been happening during the period when Occupy kind of slipped from public view? What were people doing to keep those things alive?
I mean, there's been lots of different things. The strike debt group has been organizing around debt. They were holding debtors assemblies. They've been planning projects. They did a debt resistance manual or debt resistors manual. And are organizing an event on November 15th that's called the People's Bailout, that is actually they're going to buy debt on the secondary market to then abolish it. That's one group that spun out of Occupy that still existed. There are others that are working on various other issues. And more importantly, you know, some people did just take a break and went back to their lives and sort of breathed for a few months, took a break from 24/7 organizing, 24/7 you know, being menaced by the police, and then we're able to come back now and have the energy to do this kind of work again with very little downtime.
Yeah, this is sort of confirms what Fran Piven's been saying about how social movements work. They come in ebbs and flows, and you know, they have people pronounce them dead, and then they come back because you know people have formed these connections, and consciousness has been transformed. I mean, is that what you're seeing?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is. Again, like I said, this is an extension of what we saw in the park, but it's also an extension of the work after the park. The church that they're staging out of in Sunset Park right now was the location also where they were doing a group of people that were working with some rent strikers in Sunset Park were staging out of. So that was a place that they already had the connection to be able to go in now and use the kitchen there and use it as a place to take donations and send donations out. It connects. Matt Brenner Hamlin pointed out that this sort of work is very much like what the Occupy Homes people have been doing, because that's very much community-centered work, going in and organizing in communities that have been, you know, again, that are having their homes destroyed, not by a flood, but by the banks.
And the cops, are they, I mean, you said they're policing the black community pretty heavily, but have they been interfering with the volunteers at all?
Yeah, so my friend Andrea, who was actually a resident of Seagate down on Coney Island, which is another place that was flooded, she's been staying at my house since the storm because I live in Crown Heights, which is, again, central Brooklyn, didn't flood, didn't even lose power. She went down there yesterday to try to help people clean out the complex where she lived, and Occupy Sandy had sent a couple of carloads of stuff and were apparently turned away by the police at the entrance to Seagate, wouldn't let them in.
Wow, that's amazing.
right? You know, this is...
So
NYPD.
Now we're going to engage in the debased journalistic practice of gazing in a crystal ball, but, I mean, what's this going to do to the movement over the longer term, do you think?
The thing that is most interesting to me, right, is that, like, we know that rebuilding after a storm like this is not just a matter of getting people food and water and blankets to survive the ridiculous cold that we have right now. It's a matter of working on houses, finding houses for people, making sure people don't slip through the cracks as you know, as Lower Manhattan's power goes back on, people don't forget that people out in the outer boroughs are still suffering. And so what I would love to see is this move into something like Common Ground in New Orleans, where it became a place where volunteers could come through and do a little bit of time, you know, working on houses, doing, you know, gutting homes and rebuilding. And if we could do that without the FBI infiltration, that would be really awesome. Although, you know, since it's Occupy doing it, we probably have FBI infiltration already.
All right. Well, thank you for what you're doing as both a journalist and an active human. Okay.
That was the journalist and activist Sarah Jaffe. Her piece on Occupy Sandy, a very fine piece of work, can be found on the Jacobin Magazine website, jacobinmag.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Elliot Carter's Piano Sonata No. 1, performed by Ursula Oppen. Carter died early this week at the age of 103. He was still composing up until a few months ago. I love this quote from him in his New York Times obituary. "I like to sound spontaneous and fresh, but my first sketches often sound mechanical. I have to write them over till they sound spontaneous." Next up is Anne Elizabeth Moore, Chicago-based writer and artist. She was co-editor and publisher of Punk Planet, a great magazine that's gone off to the great remainder bin in the sky. She's also author of several books and a teacher at the Art Institute of Chicago. Her latest book is Hip Hop Apsara, Ghosts, Past and Present, a collection of words and photographs about Cambodia just out from Green Lantern Books. She's been visiting and writing about Cambodia for 5 years now, and here she is to talk about a country that we don't give much thought to here in the USA. Anne Elizabeth Moore.
Welcome, Anne. How did you get interested in Cambodia?
Well, I've been running Punk Planet magazine, as you know, from 2004 to 2007, and when we shut down in June of 2007, it was for all these sort of shifting government regulations that essentially made me question whether or not the U.S. democratic project was actually open to freedom of speech. And so I started Googling,
Have you made up your mind on that one yet?
I think it's been made up for me, yeah. And so I started Googling democracy in name only and pretend democracy. And Cambodia, of course, is one of these major places that comes up when people talk about fake democracy or democracy that is a sham. And so I started getting really obsessed with what was going on there. And eventually, through several queries, an organization invited me to come and do a pretty open-ended residency program with the first large group of young women to attend college there in the history of the country. So I went there and I basically did what I did here all this time, which is make zines with young people. And then over the couple of months that I was there, I just became obsessed.
Zines seems like the 90s now, though. It's not a Tumblr.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And people do say, oh, paper blogs. And now I have to be yes, paper blogs. Whereas 3 years ago, I would have been no. How can you say that?
Cambodia. I read in Counterpunch the other day from the odious Israel Shamir that Pol Pot was really not such a bad guy after all. He's just a socialist dreamer, really. And all these tales of genocide are concoctions of propagandists. It's kind of sad we have to fact check what's supposed to be a truth telling alternative media, but just fact check that for us, please.
Yeah, well, it's really hard to even take it seriously enough to fact check because when I read that piece, I was just so deeply appalled that any left leaning publication would have taken it seriously even after the first sentence that I just lost my mind. It's a confusing thing to then have to argue because the way that the Khmer Rouge gets situated in American popular culture is not accurate either. And so the truth is that there were a lot of things about the Khmer Rouge that were basically just an American resistance movement, and that that project was about stamping out capitalism, which is a project that does, have obvious merits. To go 59 zillion steps beyond that and claim that Pol Pot wasn't such a bad guy is totally and completely ridiculous. But the truth is that the Khmer Rouge makes a lot more sense when you put it in context of the American bombings, that it essentially wiped out livestock and farmland and killed almost as many people as the Khmer Rouge regime did a couple of years later, which turns out...
I remember that stuff very well, but it's quite possible that... younger people in the audience don't know about this.
It.
But, Nixon's secret bombing and all that, just remind us of what that was all about.
I can't even fathom what it was all about. But essentially, Nixon believed, or people somewhere believed, that the Vietnamese were sort of crossing into Cambodia and organizing there. And through a complex set of negotiations, King at the time, Norodom Sihanouk, maybe allowed the U.S. to lead military actions, maybe thought it was going to happen and didn't do enough to stop it, but essentially Americans ended up bombing in the menu bombings that maybe started as early as 1967, 1968, 1969, it's totally unclear, and just dropped millions of pounds of artillery on totally defenseless, neutral peasants in a country that wasn't involved in the war at all.
Causing immense amounts of death and social disruption.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In an already poverty-stricken country, losing livestock was the last straw. So then, when the Khmer Rouge, in the northwestern part of the country, and it all makes sense geographically when you look at it, this is where, if you fly over the sort of southeastern part of the country now, there's just big holes and perfectly round lakes. And those are bomb ponds. And they're beautiful, but you can see the destruction as you go over the country. It's amazing.
40 years later.
Yeah.
More than 40 years later.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so then the Khmer Rouge did their thing,
which was easy to do because people were like, well, yeah, of course the Americans are going to start bombing again. Of course we need to go out to the countryside to farm rice. And of course, there might be a problem with Western thinking about Southeast Asia. So there is a logic here that's missing entirely when we watch movies like The Killing Fields.
Well, the explanation there was just a mysterious Eastern brutality that took hold?
I can't even remember what the exact explanation was. I think there were some small attempts at complicating the narrative. But, when you start the story of Cambodia in the middle of the Khmer Rouge regime with Pol Pot, it sounds like a crazy man took over and everyone listened to him. Why would they do that? But, sort of the Third Reich, you also have to take the socioeconomic context into consideration to get what's going on at all.
So what happened and what was the legacy?
Of the Khmer Rouge?
Yeah.
Well, they destroyed everything. They destroyed the family structure. They decreed people divorced and then forced them to remarry. So on an individual basis, people were confused and shattered. Families were broken up and sent to different parts of the country. People were put into forced labor situations. Many did starve to death. Many were killed or murdered or injured otherwise. And then sort of economically and in terms of resources, they attempted to print a new kind of money, and then they declared the old kind of money illegal. And so there was actually a sort of a gap in time where they weren't going to have any currency. And unfortunately, during that gap, the Vietnamese invaded, took over, turned the country socialist. But at the time, what that meant was that there was no money. And so everything everything had been destroyed. There were no intellectuals left to think about how to respond to this crisis. There were no people who spoke foreign languages to actually negotiate with aid workers, and there was no money, no currency.
And then weirdly at that time, the U.S. supported the Khmer Rouge as an opponent of Vietnam.
Yes, and the U.S.'s role in all of this is confusing and conflictual, and they seem to just sort of jump back and forth really quickly because they had also backed the Lon Nol government, who had originally sort of had this other role in the whole situation. So it's hard to figure out what the U.S. wanted or even what the U.S. believed was going on. But at the same time, it's also sort of hard. I mean, Sihanouk, who just died, you know, he kept sort of switching sides and switching allegiances. And there was a point at which he was actually an active supporter of the Khmer Rouge as well, because he believed that it would bring him back into the country. And of course, the Khmer Rouge are going to lie about what their project is in the first place. And so the bottom line is that by the end of the Khmer Rouge regime, I mean, a quarter of the country had been killed, between 1.7 and 2.2 million people. Very, very, very few people even had the energy to provide any sort of dissent whatsoever, but definitely no intellectual capacity. And also, you know, they'd been sold a string of goods about what that project was doing, so it's complicated.
And by now you've spent a lot of time there. What's the heritage? Do people still feel it? Is it still visible?
There's the tribunals are ongoing. And when I went there in 2007, the difficulty is that because it was such an all-encompassing regime by the end of the Khmer Rouge, and because the Vietnamese invasion and then when the UN took over the country for the first time, the UN actually administered the government of the country, the United Nations Transitional Authority in Cambodia, in an attempt to instill this democracy. When democracy was supposedly instilled, who was elected? Prime Minister Hun Sen, who happened to have been a former Khmer Rouge member and former Vietnamese government party member. So someone who'd been in power through three generations, now leading the country with direct ties to the Khmer Rouge. So media isn't really allowed to write about it, doesn't show up in any textbooks, and the families who have been through these horrible, horrible situations don't talk about it around the dinner table. So the young people I was working with didn't know that the Khmer Rouge regime happened, and they definitely didn't know about the American bombings that sort of laid the groundwork for it. So no one talks about it.
I'm speaking of with Anne Elizabeth Moore, who is an artist and writer, and just out with a beautiful little book called Hip Hop Apsara. Tell us about the title. What does that mean?
Yeah, the first wave of money coming into the country was, of course, designated for tourism. And so the country, the prime minister in particular, put all this money into developing the public way. And now that there's actually sort of a large series of platforms on the waterfront that have been recently developed, people hold these big public dance parties there. And they play some traditional Cambodian apsara music, which is a traditional Cambodian ballet. But then the young people are really into hip-hop music. So they play this mix of music, and then the most of the city, in the first move toward exercise, toward regular, a notion of exercise that's about keeping weight down and being, you know, conforming to a certain kind of appearance, are doing these big public dances out in the middle of the city of Phnom Penh, Cambodia, right in front of the prime minister's house.
Now, keeping weight down in a country where people were starving to death not all that long ago, it's a very strange transition.
Unbelievable, yeah. And one of the things that I maybe mention in an aside there, but I've written and studied extensively, is that when advertising became legal in Cambodia, which was really, so it would have been after the Vietnamese era ended, and then somewhere between there and the UNTAC years, it became legal to have advertising, but of course for the first couple of years it was only like beer and cigarette ads, and they were mostly multinational companies that were advertising there. But between then and now, really maybe 15 years, the country has developed almost as many venues and definitely as many ad sightings per young person as we have here in the U.S., but there's been no critical capacity built up around it. And so what's happening is global media is moving into Cambodia like crazy. young people are seeing global media ads. And so blonde, skinny blonde women washing their hair and talking about Pantene Pro-V or whatever ridiculous product, and being inundated with these media images that we have here in the U.S. that we have a way of responding to, but that they do not. And so now weight is an issue because it's the same models telling us the same stupid things about our bodies.
But the country is still quite poor. Where's the money coming from to buy consumer goods?
Well, the country is still quite poor. It is beginning to be slightly less poor. And the emergence of the middle class is about a couple of different things. For one, the garment industry has expanded in the last 10 years. And so there are more people that are a little bit more comfortable than there had been before that time period. But also the country has really shifted up its policies to allow for a lot more international, which is usually American businesses, to just be situated there and not necessarily, like, for example, you no longer need to be Cambodian or have a Cambodian sit on your board to actually purchase land in Cambodia to set up and operate your business. And so there's more money around, but it's unclear exactly how much of it is going back to the Cambodians. And then, of course, the stock market just opened about a year and a half ago. I think there was, well, a year and a half ago, maybe a little over a year ago. One company started trading on it immediately, a water company. And then I think two more were scheduled to be added. And it's largely about appearances. It's largely about this idea that there's a stock market. And now there are banks in the country, too, and these just started in the 90s as well.
Well, now that China's getting expensive, everybody wants to be the next China, right?
Well, and definitely. That's a big part of it, too.
Now, the garment business is, of course, classic in a poor country, a hotbed of low-wage jobs. That story is familiar, but what made Cambodia really stand out was last year was the epidemic of fainting, which you've written about.
Yes.
What happened?
Amazing. Again, it was a series of things that didn't start with the faintings that were so interesting. What happened was that in September of 2010, the largest garment strike in the history of the country, of 350,000 workers, 200,000 walked off their jobs in protest of low wages. For months, the country was just in an uproar, and people were just demanding their rights, da-da-da-da-da. And everyone, for the first time, was colloquially aware that something needed to change in the garment industry. And yet, sort of, the government proceeded to stamp out their right to dissent. And so nothing really ended up going anywhere. Through a series of really complicated firings and distractions and inactions and things like this. Then there's a couple months pause, and then all of a sudden, mass numbers of women start fainting on the factory floor. The reason, again, this is so important for Americans to keep in mind is that they're produced, 70% of the clothes they produce are exported to the U.S. These are not people that have nothing to do with our lives. These are people that are they're definitely making the clothes that I'm wearing right now for H&M and Zara, the two largest clothing manufacturers in the world, and The Gap and Banana Republic, etc. So there's this very direct relationship between what we consume, how we consume, who we pay to do it, and how people on the ground in Cambodia are reacting, and how they're reacting right now is they're fainting in these mass numbers. And so within a year, over 2,000 women had fainted on the factory floor. And then the media dropped off about it. The faintings have been continuing.
Well, it was covered kind of like it was a freak show. These weird people are fainting, right?
Exactly. And which I feel very complicated about because Cambodia is a really unusual place. As I write in Hip Hop Opsera, like, there is a belief in ghosts that's really important. But you cannot tell me that people are fainting in a factory because they're scared of ghosts. What's happening is you're not giving them enough money to buy food to allow them to withstand a day's labor. And so if they also get scared of a ghost, of course they're going to faint because they're totally exhausted from demanding their wages. Also, of course, during the same time period, both H&M and Zara and now the other clothing companies have increased their production schedules on an already broken system so that they're producing between 6 and 12 times as much clothes as they used to, but not shifting anything else about the industry. So I think there was a 3.5% raise in the number of workers 7% raise in the number of open factory positions, but something like 12 times as many clothes being produced. So jamming more stuff through a system that isn't paying people enough to do what they have to do already is, of course, going to cause some insanity.
It's very hard to automate clothing manufacturers, so it's people are being forced to work faster and harder.
Oh, yeah. There's no machines that are doubling the speed at which your jeans are being made, for sure.
No, they still haven't figured that one out yet.
No, and they probably will, and then we'll all even be more screwed.
But there's also the noxious chemicals.
Noxious chemicals, and all of those issues about occupational safety and health regulations, those are all relevant as well, and they're all sort of part of the same monitoring process that happens on the ground in garment factories everywhere, but in Cambodia in particular, that essentially, and largely it's in factories that are sort of subcontracted out, so they're not necessarily the most closely monitored factories. But yeah, there's regular violations of workers not having access to chairs to sit down if they need to. There's supposed to be healthcare workers on site at every factory, and there absolutely isn't. And there's supposed to be, I mean, there aren't even enough healthcare workers in the country to do that. So there's no system to support the improvement of this unless we sort of implement it from the top down, I guess is what I'm saying.
We're just about out of time, but I didn't really talk too much about the book, partly because it's mostly a book of photographs.
It's hard to talk about.
But just for the audience, tease them into it with a description of what the book is about.
Yeah, so the book is, so for these last 5 years that I've been spending this time in Cambodia, I've just collected all of these images that sort of talk about this nation in this great state of change, shifting from a place of mourning and loss and not even necessarily knowing what happened under the Khmer Rouge during these times of great death and destruction, and to a place where people are comfortable enough to even start thinking about their lives and their futures as celebrated in these big public dance parties. And the other side of this, of course, is that people are starting to realize that that they have and or should have access to more rights, and labor rights in particular, and in the garment factories also. And sort of a sub-theme of the book that's really interesting, especially in relationship to the garment factory paintings, is this belief in ghosts, these hauntings that happen. And in a place where there's been so much death and destruction, of course there's going to be this.
Yeah, if the history of a place ever encouraged to believe in ghosts, that would be it.
Yeah, most profoundly. And you know, I hesitate to get too loopy about it, but if you sort of accept that that's the way that you go about things, then you have this different way of understanding how people shift through space and time there. And one of the things, as you mentioned, that people are saying about the garment factories is that, you know, they're all fainting out of fear of ghosts, which isn't totally untrue, because if there is this fear of ghosts that is being fostered by these other fears and lack of access to education and lack of access to healthcare, basic human needs, then it's going to have much stronger impact. And I wouldn't even say that that's necessarily sort of a bad or weird thing. I think that a government that takes ghosts pretty seriously is a government to consider and be reckoned with.
We have a government that tries to create ghosts.
Yeah, right. It was a totally different situation.
I didn't get to ask this, but now I want to. Whenever the garment industry comes into a poor, conservative, traditional country, the garment jobs usually employ young women. They develop a degree of independence from traditional family structures. Have you seen that in Cambodia? What's it like?
Yes.
And what's it doing?
Right. It is creating some tensions. And one of the things in Cambodia that has kept the gender roles so traditional is a document called the Chabab Sarai, which is a very traditional document that deliberately sets out a set of rules for young women to follow. There's one for boys too. It's called Chabab Ros, boy rules. Boy rules are like, whatever, do whatever you want. And the rules for women are like, don't look boys in the eye, don't rustle your skirt when you move, and when your husband beats you, know that that's your lot in life. As women are becoming an economic force in the country, what that's doing is that's disrupting the traditional sense of how things should be, and there is a lot of confusion about it. Unfortunately, the model that's coming in is the American advertised model of, like, well, you know, you just have to dress a certain way, and you have to look a certain way, and you have to be sexy enough, and then everything will be fine again. But as I mentioned at the end of the book, there's this group, the Messenger Band, of really smart young women, cultural producers, that are just going around the country singing songs about labor rights issues, HIV transmission rights, and the rights of sex workers. And they're really offering one of the only spaces in the country for people to really think about gender roles and economic power and freedom in among groups of young women.
That was Anne Elizabeth Moore, author of Hip Hop Apsara, Ghosts, Past and Present, a collection of words and photographs about Cambodia just out from Green Lantern Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Dave Edmonds' Crawling from the Wreckage. We are crawling from the wreckage here in New York, but I hope not into a brand new car. Till next week, bye. Trouble, I suppose.